Meanwhile, new duties were in the making.
The mail's piling up. We've got to get it out of here right away. It'll take all the dogs you can lay your hands on.
Soon, the dogs were harnessed for work again. This time, a Scotch half-breed took care of Buck and his mates. There was no light running now. This was the mail train. It was heavy toil each day with a heavy load behind, carrying word from the world to the men who sought gold under the shadow of the North Pole. Throughout the trip, nature and the wants of lonely men conspired to give the mail train no rest. From Skagway to Dawson and back again, the trail led in a solid sheet of ice and snow and toil. Only the consideration of the men for the dogs kept them going, until at last they came to the end of the weary journey. They were all terribly footsore. No spring or rebound was left in them. Buck's 140 pounds had dwindled to 115. The drivers confidently expected a long stopover, but...
Too much mail for much of a layover, men. You take a new batch of dogs and start out again in a couple of days. The worn-out dogs are to be gotten rid of somehow.
3 days passed, by which time Buck and his mates found how really tired they were. On the fourth day, the government agent roused the dogs, for they had been sold. The dogs were driven to the camp of the new owners.
Oh, Charles, you have to take that bag of clothes out of there. However will I reach it if I want it?
For heaven's sake, Mercedes, let's get this finished and be on our way.
You didn't ask my advice, but if you did, I'd say throw away about half what you got on that there sled, or you won't get very far.
The very idea. We'll throw absolutely nothing away. We need it all.
And we didn't ask for your advice. Suppose you mind your own business.
Okay. That's okay with me, brother.
Now mush! Mush on there!
The dogs sprang against their breastbands, straining hard, but they were unable to move the heavily loaded sled.
Mush! The lazy brutes. I'll show them.
You fool. If you had a brain in your head, you'd know the runners are frozen solid. Throw your weight against the G-pole, right and left, and break it out.
Following the advice of the spectator, Hal broke out the runners, which had been frozen to the snow. The overloaded and unwieldy sled forged ahead, Buck and his mate struggling frantically under the rain of blows from the whip. 100 yards ahead, the path turned and sloped steeply into the main street. As they swung on the turn, the sled tipped over, spilling half its load. The dogs never stopped. The lightened sled bounded on its side behind them. They gave no heed to Hal shouting.
Whoa! Whoa! Whoa!
Kind-hearted citizens finally caught the dogs and gathered up the scattered belongings. Also, they gave more advice.
You'd better wise up, mister. Get rid of a lot of that stuff. Throw away that tent, at least half those blankets and all those dishes. Do you think you're traveling on a Pullman? And get yourself a few more dogs if you expect to reach Dawson.
After a layover to dispose of material, Hal and Charles shopped around and returned with 6 additional dogs, without realizing the sled would not be large enough to haul food for that many. Then they started again.
We're really doing things upright, Charles. 14. The most the others have is 8.
Charles, Hal, wait a moment.
Now look, Mercedes, get down off that sled. You can't ride there.
I'm going to anyway. You have more dogs, so I'm going to ride. You're treating me horribly.
And that is where Mercedes rode. Neither Charles nor Hal could move her. The already spent animals had little heart for the journey under the leadership of men in whom they had no confidence. Before the trip was half over, the dog food had given out. Hal finally traded his revolver for some frozen horsehide, but it was a poor substitute for meat. Before long, only 5 dogs remained. It was beautiful spring weather now.
What'll we do, Hal? These dogs don't take to the horsehide. They're dying off fast.
What else have we got? Anyway, we'll soon be in Dawson.
Look, Hal, the ice is giving way in spots. Our runner just sank a bit.
So what? The White River stood up so far. What makes you think it won't last the rest of the way?
100 yards further on, the party came upon the camp of John Thornton. The exhausted dogs dropped wearily in their tracks.
They say, you, how much farther is it to Dawson?
You're a little over halfway there. You're lucky you're not drowned, though. The river is mighty dangerous. If you take my advice, you won't try it. Besides, your dogs
Don't ask for your advice. I know what I'm doing.
I wonder.
The idea. He's positively rude. Imagine not going to Dawson. Imagine staying here till winter.
As for the dogs, they'll move when I tell them. All right, you beasts. Mush! Mush!
The club brought the dogs slowly to their feet, all but Buck. In spite of the beating, he refused to ride.
I'll beat your rotten brains out if you have any. Get up, do you hear? Get up!
You strike that dog again, I'll kill you.
It's my dog. Get out of my way or I'll fix you. I'm going to Dawson and you won't stop me.
Look out!
Thornton picked up Hal's knife and cut Buck's traces. Hal had no more fight left in him. He placed another of the dogs in the lead position and started off.
You're in bad shape, boy. That fellow must be a madman.
Now mush! Get going! We wasted enough time here.
Imagine, threatening to kill Hal. I should think you would have stood up for him, Charles.
He seemed to be doing all right by himself. Fool thing to pull a knife anyway.
A quarter of a mile down the river of ice, the feud was still waxing strong.
To think I married a coward.
Oh, shut up, will you?
Suddenly, the ice under the team began to split up. Then a whole section of ice gave way.
Help! Help!
Charles! Hal!
Another moment, and the yawning hole was all that was to be seen. John Thornton had helplessly watched it all.
I tried to warn them, but they knew it all. Buck, you must have known what was going to happen.
John Thornton had frozen his feet the previous December. His partners had left him in camp with two dogs while they went up the river for a raft of saw logs. So now the spring days were spent in peace and idleness.
Well, old pals, soon Pete and Hans will be back and our loafing will be over.
A rest feels very good after one had traveled 3,000 miles. And Buck waxed lazy as his muscles swelled out. Skeet, Thornton's little female Irish setter, quickly made friends with Buck. Buck at last had found in John Thornton a kindness and love that he had never known before, even in the Southland. In return, he adored the master with a fierce devotion. One day, Thornton's partners arrived. Buck saw at once that Thornton was fond of them, so the dog decided to tolerate Hans and Pete, nothing more. The men seemed to understand, for they understood dogs.
He's a one-man dog, all right, John. I'd hate to start a fight with you while he's around.
How truly Pete had spoken was shown a short time later down the river, where the partners disposed of their log raft. They stopped at a tavern where a rough character named Black Burton was picking a quarrel.
We eat your kind for breakfast.
I didn't mean any harm.
Hold on, Burton. This youngster is no match for you. Leave him alone.
Okay. I'll take it out on you.
It would have been murder had not the others hauled Buck off, and had not John Thornton spoken.
Come, Buck. Come, boy.
Deep as his love was for John Thornton, however, there grew stronger in Buck the call of the wild and his answer to the call of the wild. Eat or be eaten, kill or be killed. Thornton alone held him. Other men and other men's property were as nothing except as a source for answering and filling his own needs for survival.
Buck, you come back here. That meat isn't ours. That's stealing.
In the fall of the year, Buck saved John's life in quite another manner. The three partners were guiding a long, narrow poling boat down a bad stretch of river.
Look out, John. By jingo, East Bad Rapids.
Better check it with the rope, Hans.
Hey!
By jingo, I pulled too hard. John, fall in.
Buck dove in on the instant. Thornton was being swiftly carried downstream.
Buck, come back, come back.
But it was too late. Buck was swimming downstream, and soon he had reached Thornton. Thornton grabbed Buck's tail, and Buck headed for the bank, swimming with all his splendid strength. Progress shoreward was slow. Progress downstream amazingly rapid. From below came the fatal roaring where the wild current went wilder. Thornton knew that the shore was impossible. He clutched a slippery rock top with both hands, releasing Buck.
Go, Buck, go!
I guess John's a goner. If Buck can't make it, nobody can.
We try one other thing, maybe.
We can't hold that rock much longer. He's getting weak.
We tie rope to Buck. He swim out again for John. Buck, you've got to swim to John, and we'll haul both you out. You understand? This gotta work or John die.
Buck leaped into the river and swam to where he was directly above Thornton. Then he turned and headed down upon him with the speed of an express train. John grabbed Buck and held tight. In the sweep of the current, both man and dog were jerked under the water. Desperately, Hans and Pete hauled them toward the riverbank.
Pull, Pete, pull! We got them! Pull!
We'll have to work fast if we want to bring them too. They're practically drowned.
In time, both man and dog were brought to consciousness.
Thanks, boys. You know how grateful I am.
Glad you made it, John.
How's Buck, boys?
Not so good, John. Look him over yourself.
Three broken ribs. That settles it. We camp right here till they mend.
Buck did mend. And that winter at Dawson, he performed another exploit that put his name many notches higher on the totem pole of Alaskan fame. Men were boasting of their dogs in front of the El Dorado Saloon.
My dog can start a sled with 700 pounds and walk off with it.
Buck can start 1,000 pounds.
That's going too far, Thornton. I got 20 50-pound sacks of flour on my sled. $1,000 says your dog can't break it out and walk off with it for 100 yards.
$1,000? Where would I... Well, if my word's good enough for the loan of 1,000 from anyone here, I'll take you up on that bet.
I'll lend it to you, John. Anyone question my credit? Okay. Harness the dog.
Buck, as you love me, pull this sled. As you love me.
The crowd was tense, expectant. Thornton's voice ran sharp.
Gee!
Buck swung hard to the right to loosen the runners.
Ho!
It's loose.
It's loose.
It is loose. That's the way.
Go, John.
Now mush. Buck, mush.
Buck threw himself forward with a jarring lunge. His great chest was low to the ground, his feet flying like mad. The sled lurched ahead in what appeared to be a rapid succession of jerks, though it never really came to a dead stop. Half an inch, 2 inches. Then the sled gained momentum, and at last... The money won allowed Thornton and his partners to journey into the East after a fabled lost mine. Dying men had sworn to its existence, but no one had ever found it and lived.
If we find it, our fortunes will be made. If we don't, we'll be none the poorer for our journey.
To Buck, it was boundless delight, this hunting, fishing, and wandering. For weeks at a time, they would move on steadily, and then for weeks they would camp. Months came and went. Back and forth they twisted through uncharted vastness. Buck would often roam alone through the wilds. The instincts would awaken. Memories of things he had never seen. A sense memory of ages of dog ancestors and savage men. Sometimes the dream memories would become very real as he dozed by the campfire. In those dream memories, he recalled the wild urges that made senses alert. Then he would remember the thrill of killing other wild things. Although the men did not find a lost mine, they did come upon a shallow stream in a broad valley where gold showed like yellow butter across the bottom of the washing pan. They sought no further. One night, Buck sprang from his sleep with a start. From the forest came a call, distinct and more definite than ever before. A howl, yet unlike that of any husky dog. Buck sprang through the sleeping camp in swift silence and dashed through the woods. Though the sound of the howl was new, it was as if he had known it always. Cautiously, Buck followed his instincts. Then, suddenly, the howling stopped. Buck faced the timber wolf. The wolf fled at the sight of Buck, who was much larger and heavier. Buck followed, with wild leapings to overtake the wolf. When cornered, the wolf prepared for the expected attack, but none came. Then the wolf again dashed off at the first opportunity, but Buck followed. The wolf, finding no harm was intended, sniffed noses with Buck. After some time, the wolf started off again, in a manner that showed plainly that Buck was to follow, and follow he did. But suddenly, Buck remembered John Thornton, and he turned back abruptly. The wolf began once more to howl, but Buck did not look back. However, Buck had the blood longing, and it had become stronger each day. On the way back, he came upon a moose herd. He sought out a huge bull of vicious temper and dogged him until the others of the herd left their brother moose and journeyed on their way. For 4 days, Buck worried the big bull, allowing him no time for food or water or sleep, until at last, at the end of the fourth day, Buck sprang at the throat of his prey. For a day and a night, Buck remained by the kill, eating and sleeping. Then, rested and refreshed, turned toward the camp and John Thornton. But as he neared the camp, he was oppressed with a sense of calamity, if it were not calamity already happened. Buck proceeded with more speed and greater caution. He slid along with the obscureness of a gliding shadow. His nose was jerked suddenly to the side as though a positive force had gripped and pulled it. He followed the scent into a thicket and found the dog Nig, dead. Bellying forward to the edge of the clearing, he found Hans, feathered with arrows like a porcupine. From within the camp came the strange sounds of the Yeehaw Indians in a war dance. For a moment, Buck looked on in silence. Then, for the last time in his life, he allowed passion to usurp cunning and reason. And it was because because of his great love for John Thornton that he lost his head. The Yeehats heard a fearful roar and saw rushing upon them an animal the like of which they had never seen before. It was Buck, a live hurricane of fury, hurling himself upon them in a frenzy to destroy. There was no withstanding him. He plunged into their midst, rending and destroying. Truly, Buck was a fiend incarnate, and the Yeehats, trying to spear him in close quarters, speared one another instead. Panic seized the Yeehats, and they fled in terror to the woods, Buck at their heels, dragging them down as they raced through the trees. Soon wearying of the pursuit, Buck returned to the desolate camp. He found Pete in his blankets, killed in the first moment of surprise. Thornton's desperate struggle was fresh written on the earth, and Buck scented every detail of it down to the edge of a large, deep pool. By the edge lay Skeet, faithful to the last. The pool itself effectually hid what it contained, and it contained John Thornton. For a day, Buck brooded by the pool or roamed about the camp. He knew John Thornton was dead, and it left a great void in him, somewhat akin to hunger, but a void which ached and ached. At times, when he passed the body of an Indian, he forgot the pain of it, and within him grew a great sense of self-pride. He had killed man, the noblest game of all. He had killed in the face of club and fang. Night came and a full moon rose high in the sky.
Oh.
Buck heard again the wild howls of the timber wolf. Buck walked to the center of the open space and listened. It was the call of the wild, and as never before, Buck was ready to obey. John Thornton was dead. The last tie was broken. Man and the claims of man no longer bound him. Hunting their living meat, the wolf pack had at last invaded Buck's valley. Into the clearing where the moonlight streamed, they poured in a silvery flood. And in the center of the clearing stood Buck, motionless as a statue, waiting for them. They were awed, so still and large he stood. After a moment's pause, the pack rushed Buck, but he snarled and used his fangs to good advantage. He seemed to be everywhere at once, and finally he sought out and killed the largest of the pack. So well did Buck hold himself that at last the wolves gave up. Accepting him, one wolf, long and lean, advanced curiously in a friendly manner. Then the others came forward and Buck ran with them, wild and free at last, answering the call of the wild, obeying the law of the wild, kill or be killed, eat or be eaten. The years were not many when the Yeehats noticed a change in the breed of timber wolves. They had splashes of brown on the head and muzzle, and a rift of white centering down the chest. Yes, they're a new kind of wolf, and very terrible. And they tell of a ghost dog that runs at the head of the pack. Once the Yeehats crossed into a certain valley, and the ghost dog sprang upon them. Yeehats never tread that valley anymore. In the summers, there is one visitor, however, to that valley of which the Yeehats do not know. It is a gloriously coated wolf, alike and yet unlike all other wolves. He comes alone. Sometimes to sit above a yellow stream of gold that is poured from rotted moose hide sacks, overgrown with grass and vegetable mold that hide the yellow from the sun. And here he muses for a time, howling once, long and mournfully, ere he departs.